For the week of May 31st, 2020, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 496, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in The Good Place, I'm Michael Giltz.
The Good Place being not heaven or a...
Maybe it's The Bad Place, actually. I'm not so sure. I've been watching the NBC sitcom The Good Place, starring Kristen Bell and Ted Danson, among others. I'm enjoying the show a lot. I watched the first three seasons. I thought there were only three because I was watching it on Netflix, and suddenly I realized there's a fourth season. I'm ready. But the series just ended, and it has fallen into that black hole where the series ended on one channel, but it's not yet available anywhere else. So I could buy the fourth season, but I cannot watch all the episodes of the fourth season anywhere. If you go to Hulu or NBC.com, you'll find episodes 9 through 13, but not episodes 1 through 8. If you go to Netflix, they don't have the season at all. You just can't find it anywhere. And we're going, people are so impatient. You know, I watched three seasons in about 3 months, and I'm ready for the fourth season. Where is it? Come on. So it will probably pop up on Netflix by the fall. And if I was paying attention, I could have taped the final season on NBC. It's not available on demand even, or I could have, you know, done this or that or watched it as it appeared on Hulu. But I let it slip through the cracks. I wasn't ready. Now I'm ready. And the show is unavailable for a few months. And I'm tapping my toes like I'm being so inconvenienced. And I think this is the new attitude of a lot of consumers, which is why, even though I disagree with it, Hollywood thinks they should be making more movies available earlier and crush that windowing, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Now, here's a question about Kristen Bell.
Mm-hmm. She's the best.
She's a lot of fun. Did you ever watch Veronica Mars?
Oh, yes, of course.
And did you watch the fourth season of Veronica Mars, which is on Hulu?
No, I did not.
Okay, because it went from like wholesome entertainment.
It was never wholesome. It was always dark.
It was dark, but not like sexually explicit.
They were adults. You know, they'd grown up.
Yeah. Wow. I mean,
No, she's a great talent. The first season of Veronica Mars was great. After that, they sort of got in trouble. First, they had, you know, half a season was one mystery, another half was another. They're trying to save the show. It got a little messed up. And then once by the time they came back to it, they were in a different place than the show was originally. It wasn't in high school anymore. But she was a great talent on that show. She's a great talk show guest. And I love The Good Place. And if William Jackson Harper, Chidi on the show is listening to the show, hey, call or write to us, please.
Yes,
we think you're very, very talented.
Yes. He is, actually. He is very, very good.
He's great. No, he's nerdy perfection.
Now you also have something before, like you have like a list of things you wanted to get to before we even started the show here. CBS News, I guess, let me guess. I don't even know what you're going to say, but I know they like laid off half of everyone. They basically took an axe. They laid off
a lot of people, as did some other media outlet. Of course, that's happening a lot. That's why this recovery is not going to be quick and fast. It's not going to be a V-shaped recovery because the economy was fairly hollowed out before the pandemic struck and revealed the weakness of the economy. So that's one problem. But CBS News, of course, fired a lot of people. They had a meeting with either, I think, staff and others. And one of the top people at CBS News said, well, now, yes, we have discussed some of our corporate execs taking a pay cut amidst all these layoffs. They're discussing it. It's out there. It hasn't happened yet, but they're discussing it. So that they feel obliged to at least say it's crossed our minds as we fire everybody, that maybe the top people should not be making such obscene amounts of money. So that was
it crossed our minds. And as it crossed, it left our minds immediately.
Yes. And that is only going to work for so long. And of course, a good longtime friend of the show, Marina Zenovich, terrific documentary filmmaker. She's done great documentary films in the past. And she has a new 30 for 30 on ESPN about cyclist Lance Armstrong, his rise and fall and then further fall. That's just aired in two parts. You can watch it on demand on ESPN on like The Good Place. I've heard great things about it. I wanted to watch it all at once. I know you watched it and thought it was really good, didn't you, Sperling?
Yes, I did. I watched it at Sundance. It was accepted to the or selected for the Sundance Film Festival. And I watched it there, and there was an intermission, like 2.5 hours in, there was like a little intermission. And then we came back for the second part.
Did you have like an energy bar and drink some water really quick and then jump back on into your seat?
I did get a blood transfusion. Just, I was like, you know what I really need to finish this movie in first place is a blood transfusion.
So that's some of the stuff we talked about in previous episodes. What are we going to talk about this week?
Well, this week on Showbiz Sandbox, we are speaking out, really. We're going to speak out.
No peace,
No, yeah, that, and we're going to be talking about the entertainment business. That's what I was really talking about. No. Yeah. I'm going to save Michael's political commentary for the EBD of the show. And after the credits have rolled, really, that's what I'm talking about. And by the way, for that, you're welcome. We'll have the latest on all the challenges facing the industry and the world, the pandemic, the economic collapse, the protests, the climate crisis, you name it. Okay, the only way we'll cover the climate crisis is by looking at the new movies it might inspire. On Inside Baseball, we'll look at my arch nemesis and the enemy of all parents everywhere on earth, TikTok. Natalie Jarvie, the Hollywood Reporter's senior digital media editor, she's going to join us actually to discuss how TikTok is doing YouTube one better as a launching pad for new talent. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll discuss some of the week's top headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on last week's video on demand charts. Every time I say that, it gets me. Every single time.
And it's not really last week. It's about 2 weeks ago. We're covering the most popular titles in North America for the week of May 11th through May 17th. So it's really the movies that came out the weekend of May 11th, 12th, and 13th and stuff that carried over from previous weeks. We don't know how much money they made. This doesn't include premium video on demand. This is just stuff that you can rent for about $3 or $4 or $5, stuff that you're watching online. You say you don't want to wait it to come to your streaming service or your cable channel. You want to watch it now. The most popular film on demand last week in North America was Blumhouse's Fantasy Island. I think that's new to the chart, though I don't know if I watched it a week earlier or so because it was a holiday. At number two is Bad Boys for Life with Will Smith and Martin Lawrence. At number three is Sonic the Hedgehog. And the studio announced, you know what? We're going to make a Sonic the Hedgehog 2. You're welcome.
At surprising absolutely nobody.
Well, it wasn't such a big hit, it was a given, but it looked like there would be another one because it did well enough. And number four is Bloodshot. That was an attempt to launch a new franchise and universe starring, was it Vin Diesel?
Yes, Vin Diesel.
That's right. And number five is Emma, another remake of the Jane Austen classic. This one starring Anna Taylor-Joy. And at number six was Capone starring Tom Hardy. No. He mumbles a lot. Yes.
Yeah. And everybody thought, oh, it's just Christopher Nolan. He doesn't he doesn't want us to hear the dialogue. And then he put that mask on Bane in that last Batman movie. No, actually, when you try and talk to him, he's like, well, yeah.
And it's Mad Max. And now it's Capone. The guy likes to mumble. And he's a very good actor. He was terrific in Dunkirk, too. At number seven is Jumanji, The Next Level. And number eight is The Call of the Wild with Harrison Ford and a digital dog. At nine, Survive the Night, a thriller starring Bruce Willis and Chad Michael Murray. Oh, hey, Chad, I remember you. But Bruce Willis, Chad Michael Murray, bad, bad reviews for this hostage flick. And at number 10, 1917. So that's my favorite movie on this chart. I have not seen Capone or Emma, but those are the three I would most like to see. One of them I saw and I thought it was good. Those are the most popular movies on demand. And of course, the big news is that we're trying to get back to Hollywood. And there is some good news there when we're looking at our coronavirus update, our pandemic update. Hollywood, Australia, China, people are either back to filming movies and TV shows or they're working on the rules for doing so. We're getting, 60-page letters detailing how it's going to work, or they're already filming. In one part of China that's a hotbed of filming, about 40 projects are back in production, and another 60 are preparing to do so. Of course, in New Zealand, we know that Avatar 2, 3, 4, and 5 are getting back to work. So that's good news on the filming front. We're happy to see that. And of course, cinemas need to open as well. In France, cinemas are allowed to reopen starting June 22nd. Whether they'll have enough product to do so, or maybe they'll just show reruns of, Day for Night.
Remember, France has a lot of its own homegrown content.
Well, a lot of people do, of course, but there's their new product ready to go. Our studio's ready to release it with all these restrictions. There will be audiences ready if theaters open up in North America, but until studios make product available, a lot of the big chains are saying, we're not opening up until there's a new movie to show. So I'm wondering the same thing in France. Vive le cinéma, but we need a new cinema. Got to give us new movie so we can bring people back in.
The operating cost is part of the problem, really. I talked to a number of exhibitors here in the U.S. who are saying, look, we just can't make the math pencil, based on the number of people that are walking through the door with all the cleaning that we have to do with the showtime. So actually, one of them, Studio Movie Girl, had a very good idea. They said, we might only open up in the evenings. and only instead, well, show. Well,
why bother showing? Content. Why bother showing movies during the day when it costs too much to sterilize the theater for two people?
Right. And they said, we will make it, instead of showing Back to the Future every week or every day of the week for a week, we will do a Back to the Future night. Come for your dinner. And because they're a dine-in cinema, come for your dinner, stay for the movie, and then that'll be it. You can't see it again, which is kind of a bad idea.
Well, that's not going to work long-term, obviously. Will the numbers work if they can open up and have two showings during the week and four showings on the weekend at 50% capacity? If they have one movie in their 12-screen cinema, they'll be able to make money, right?
Yes, correct.
If they have it on every screen, 50% capacity, they're thinking, we can do five screenings on the weekend, and we can do two in the evening, right?
Yes,
during correct. The weekday. That's so absolutely does that work for them, do you think?
Yes, and here's what they're saying. They're saying, look, when we are really, really doing well, we're great at 30% capacity. However,
right, but that means their seats are full during their evening performances.
Correct.
And right, that's, they can't do
the
that
problem
now.
The problem with averaging is that you just hit the nail on the head. It's like, yeah, 30%, because at 2 o'clock you had nobody in the theater, and at 7 p.m. you had 150 people in your 150 seat auditorium.
Right. So they're saying, if we have 75 seats sold twice an evening and sell 150 tickets for that theater, and we have 12 theaters and they're all showing the same movie, this will work for us.
Correct.
Okay. So they're saying it will work if they can come back, as long as they have a movie to show.
Right.
It's got to be Mulan. It's got to be Tenet. And I'm not sure that they can show two movies at a time. You know, they're talking about if you're going to have limited screenings and not bother to open up during the day, I don't see how you can make money with two movies competing for an audience. Now you're going to have 10 screens for one movie and 10 for the other, or six screens for one and six screens for the other. Will that pay off? I don't know. The movies would have to play a lot longer for them to you know, back it up. It'll take them a full week just to make what they would make in 3 days.
Probably.
Yeah. Well, 50%, right?
Yeah.
And that's counting 100% capacity. So that's the challenges that they face. But everybody's still figuring out the rules. At CNN, this is separate from the protests going on, they announced that their staffers will stay out of the office until 2021.
Does this mean Chris Cuomo is going to be doing the show from his basement until then?
It does indeed. But that's, you know, these are the challenges that we're facing. In Broadway, the Broadway League came out and spoke up, and they said, you know what? We're optimistic. That's a quote. They think January may be a return date for Broadway. We heard a lot of producers saying March was more likely, but they anticipate masks and temperature checks in January, but no 50% capacity. That just doesn't work. Broadway cannot open up. Movies and cinema houses, they have movies that are there. They have their staff. They have their costs. But their costs are low compared to a Broadway theater. Broadway theater, they have to spend $700,000 to $800,000 a week to put on a show with a live audience and a musical. So when they're doing that, they can't make money, even if at 50% they sell out the whole place.
And by the way, that's true. That's true on the West End as well. It's true in Paris.
Of course. Yeah, it's not just Broadway unions. Andrew Lloyd Webber says stage doors are a thing of the past. That may never happen again. Your celebs waiting there with your playbill, kissing, hugging, taking photos with them, shaking their hands, handing them your playbill, they hand it back. It's just never going to happen again. You're just begging people to get sick. The Phantom was touring UK and Ireland. That was a planned tour for 14 months of Phantom of the Opera. That has been canceled forever. So it isn't just new shows that were about to hit Broadway that have fallen through the cracks. We're now seeing some shows that were on Broadway, like Frozen. Those have been canceled. Now we have touring productions that we're going to head out. Those have been canceled. And Actors Equity says, oh, you want to open up in March or January? That's nice. But we, the actors, should not be epidemiological guinea pigs. We have no interest in coming back to work until things are safe. We're not there to risk our lives and die so that you can get your show back up and running and make some money. We want to get back to work. Everybody does. We have to do it in a safe fashion. Until we can be safe doing it, we're not going to come back at all. So that's kind of a splash of cold water, I think, for anybody else who thinks January, February, sure, why not?
Here's a splash of cold water for you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the Greek theater, you know, the Doors played the Greek theater.
Sure.
You know, lots of people played the Greek theater. Yeah, you know who's playing the Greek theater this summer?
Who?
Nobody. Nobody's playing the Greek
theater. Well, of course.
They canceled their entire summer program.
Just like the Hollywood Bowl and everybody else, there will be no summer programs for anyone. We know
that. And what that really means is the Greek theater is a stop. If you're playing LA and you're playing in the summer, you're going to stop at either the Greek theater. And if you're Taylor Swift, yes, you're going to play the Forum or the Staples Center, but those are like, or the Hollywood Bowl. Those are gigantic audiences.
We're more of a Greek theater type podcast, right? That's where we would play.
Correct. We would definitely, you know, 5,000-7,000 people. Yes.
Yeah, absolutely.
So if you're like Alanis Morissette, you're playing the Greek theater, you know, and maybe that,
She's a big star. I don't know that. Yeah.
Yeah, that's true. Maybe she can. Yeah. Actually, I think she was playing the Hollywood Bowl. So somebody's going to write in and prove me wrong, but you know what I mean. So like, right. I saw Jackson and I'm saying all these old artists, that you get kind of ages me, but, you know,
it's
I
not,
don't know.
That's not what ages you. It's your age that ages you.
True. Yes.
If you really want a splash of cold water, however, go to SeaWorld. SeaWorld is opening up in Florida in mid-June, and Disney World, they are not opening up their water theme parks because that's where people are together in the water, unlike SeaWorld where you are watching shows. At their water theme parks, you mix it in with other people. Those are not reopening, but everything else is. They're looking at mid-July, the Magic Kingdom, Animal Kingdom, Epcot, and Disney's Hollywood Studios. I have great friends who are huge fans of theme parks. These are adults with no children, and they love theme parks, and they go all the time. They go annually. They make big trips. They go to horror nights in Universal. They go to Disney World. They love it. They are members. I asked them. I said, hey, you guys, are you going to, Michael and Rosie, are you guys going to head on out to the theme parks? I go, you know, you want to wait till you're safe. And of course, you're going to go out. You're going to be wearing masks and gloves. But the temptation of being there when the amusement park is at a third of capacity, that's really appealing because you just can't go there when it's not jammed to the gills. And they said, yeah, no, we're not going.
They're like, oh, absolutely not. Yeah.
They have reservations. They already did for December because that was when Disney was starting to do its like 50th or 75th I forget what the celebration year is, but it's a big celebration year for Disney World. So they'd already booked well in advance. They didn't go last year because they wanted to save up. There were going to be more stuff opening. All of Star Wars would be open by then. They have lots of special events for that year, and they're hardcore fans. They are scheduled to go in December, but that may change. They may yank that and reschedule that for 2021. So we'll have to see what happens. But even hardcore fans, yes, they're going to be reopening up. We've seen crowds showing up as soon as they did that in other parts of the world. There may be that initial rush, but then after that, especially as the pandemic continues, and there's going to be obviously another rise and wave because that's what all the scientists say. I'm not talking about our opinion. I'm just saying
that's literally every pandemic ever has had two waves.
Right. Or it just never stops, you know, bubbling over and under and just continues to get up and down and up and down. So there will presumably be a bigger crest of problems coming up in the summer or the fall or the winter. And that means that will certainly chill people going out and heading to the park. But it hasn't chilled Warner Brothers. Warner Music Group, they are going to launch their IPO. They're putting 70 million shares onto NASDAQ at $23 to $26. We'll have to see how they do. But they're saying, you know what? Streaming numbers are good. People are still listening to music. We're ready to go ahead. And the same thing's true for Cannes, isn't it?
Yeah, they are going to announce the films that were selected for this year's festival, even though that festival has, for the most part, been canceled. They still have yet to cancel it, by the way.
Right.
It's still not canceled.
They're not saying these are official selections. They're just saying these are certain films that we want to champion. And we want to say they have our seal of approval. So it is not an official selection.
No, this is the selection. They said they will be announcing the selection for the 73rd annual. And I was like, really? You're going to actually say that it's a selection?
Huh,
because
okay.
And this has been a big, bit of a controversial, if you will. Here's why. If you're Toronto, does that mean, and you're showing that film that was selected by Cannes, does that mean you're the premiere?
Well, yeah, of course you are. No one's seen it.
Right, exactly. So it's, you know, and so if you, in other words, if you're
I apologize. So 2 days from now, you guys will be listening to the show and they are calling it a revised official selection. I thought they were just going to be saying, yeah, these are cool films.
No,
but obviously it's, you know, it's a lot of asterisks by that. You know, there are a lot of films that couldn't be shown to them on time because they couldn't finish what they were working on. You know, it's a big mess. So, you know, it's a big mess for everybody. They're doing the best they can. They feel like putting that label on a movie can help it. So good for them. Why not? It certainly doesn't mess up Toronto or Telluride or anywhere to anybody else. And by the way, Telluride and Toronto think they're going ahead. I don't know about that. But English Premier League is going ahead. The Bundesliga has been playing to empty stadiums for a while now. That's okay. You can see them on TV. And English Premier League soccer, that is returning on June 17th. Go Liverpool.
Now, here's a question for you. So you and I are both baseball fans.
Yes.
Right? So they're thinking of bringing back Major League Baseball here in the U.S. For 82 games, which is roughly, it's almost exactly half the number of games of a regular season.
Uh-huh.
And so the owners, the team owners have turned to the players and said, okay, we're going to do that, and we will gladly pay you 25% of your regular salary. And the players have said, wait, you know, this math is pretty simple. We're playing half the games.
Right.
So,
and no matter how much money you make, we don't get extra. We don't make more money when you make more money. So why are we suddenly making less money when you make less money? It's a big kerfuffle. It's millionaires arguing with millionaires, but there are a lot of younger players.
It's billionaires arguing with millionaires.
Yeah. So there are a lot of young players who haven't made a lot of money yet, and they live week to week, and their careers are threatened because it's hard to stay in shape. So I empathize with them. It's hard to get to the show, and they're there, and they're ready to play, and they're, you know, going to be making six figures, but it's a lot of people chipping in at that money. So they're not all living it up large like a handful of the big superstars. So I am
not like you and I are, Michael.
That's right. So I empathize with a lot of the players, especially the newer ones, the younger ones, and the journeymen. But, you know, they've all got arguments on their side. It's a big mess. They'll presumably work it out and play some baseball.
Yeah. Well, you know, I've already written to both the Yankees and the Dodgers and said, look, you know, if you can't work it out with those guys,
you're available for Waterboy.
I'll gladly do it for 25% of the money. Okay.
Well, we've been talking a lot about all this stuff. We've got the pandemic. We've got the economic collapse. We have got the climate crisis, and we have the unrest or the uprising in North America. And in fact, around the world, we've seen protests and people speaking out in Berlin and Paris and London. That was awesome.
New Zealand, Auckland, New Zealand.
Talking about the police brutality, policemen killing people in broad daylight in front of people, videotaping them, begging them not to. It is shocking and shouldn't remain shocking. That should be what's upsetting today, not the unrest that has followed. If you watch the news coverage, you know, I guarantee you the evening news is starting right here in 15 minutes where I'm at in Birmingham, Alabama, the national evening news. If there is one police car that is set on fire in the entire country, I assure you that will be the video they show tonight. I don't watch Twitter a lot. I don't go on Twitter, but I stumbled on it because a friend sent me something to look at. And I ended up on a thread of someone saying, here's a lot of the peaceful demonstrations that you're not seeing on a loop on the evening news. And there are some people, and according to governors and police chiefs and others, there are some people from radical groups on the far, far right, and according to the president, the far left, who are using this as an excuse to try and create havoc and mayhem. That's true. But the vast majority of people are protesting peacefully. And I wish the news would do a better job of covering that. But what's shocking to me and surprising and welcome, though I'm puzzled by it, is what some of our major entertainment companies are doing at this crucial moment. It would be easy for them to stay silent, but they're not.
Yeah, they're actually kind of going out and, you know, kind of siding with Black Lives Matter. And they're not just, you know, posting tweets and going to Twitter and Instagram. You know, A24, for instance, said, look, you know, I think everybody knows we are the film distribution company that released, Moonlight. So, you know, that we promote diverse voices, but we have to do it in our company as well. And so over the next couple of days, they're going to be looking at how they can do it, not only with the content that they're distributing, but with the people they're hiring and the programs that they're putting in place within their own company.
Right. We're going to want to see some follow through. But Amazon, Netflix, HBO, Hulu, Stars, they all voiced support for Black Lives Matter and the protesters and the people rising up and saying enough is enough in terms I find surprisingly explicit and clear. They're not saying, we want calm and love and justice. They're like saying, no, we're on this side. And I was really kind of surprised by that. Disney did not name Black Lives Matter, but they all but did. And the rest of their statement was quite explicit and strong as well. You know, there's a shooting. None of these major corporations want to be seen saying, hey, maybe you don't need an AK-47. Maybe you don't need a weapon of war. They don't do that. You know, they just say our thoughts and prayers are here. In this case, I am surprised they really have placed their money down at least verbally. We'll have to see if they follow through with money. We'll have to see if they follow through, say, Amazon by paying their employees better. You want to prove that you care? Start paying your employees a livable wage. You know, let them unionize. That would be steps one and two. But I'm very surprised and interested that they chose this moment when there are, as anyone could say, cities are burning and there's havoc in LA. Well, they see people angry, upset, and they want to be on their side. And I was kind of surprised and fascinated by that. We'll have to see where it ends up. They'll need to follow through because a tweet is not enough. It's no
would
big,
you say it?
A tweet is no big deal unless you follow through with some actual change and put your money where your mouth is.
Oh, I like the way you're moving us along into Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Whew, that was a mouthful. Our first story. Okay, we've discussed this story before. The cinematographer Greg St. John's worked on the hit CBS show Criminal Minds for 14 years. During that time, he allegedly fondled, groped, and sexually harassed numerous male employees on set. Those who risked their jobs and careers to complain say their requests fell, well, on deaf ears, and indeed, a number of them were ultimately fired. This went on for years until Variety wrote a detailed story describing the many complaints lodged by many crew members over the years. When we talked about it, our astonishment was that this wasn't the show's star or showrunner. It was the cinematographer.
I mean,
okay?
You wouldn't think he'd have that much power.
Right. Well, now the state of California is also taking action. It's suing Disney, ABC Studios, and CBS Studios, along with key executive producers on the show, demanding back pay and damages for all the workers who suffered this abuse and the hit to their careers. Needless to say, all the companies and people involved deny improper action. So basically, I'm going to ask, is this a big deal or a big whoop? And then I guess it's
a big whoop because it's just a lawsuit being filed. But that's what happens when you get good coverage in the media. When Variety does a great job and covers this story, it lights a fire under people and they take action. And they are holding everyone to account. It's not just the individual execs on the show. They're saying, hey, you don't get off just because normally they go after one person or two and it's not the big studio. They're going after everyone. And these people did really suffer. You're on a show like Criminal Minds. That's a job for 8 years, 5 years, 10 years, 14 years that you can feast on. That's a huge difference to your life and your career and your stability for your family. So it really does matter a lot that they were fired. I'm excited to see that they're moving forward. We'll have to see where it ends up. What do you think?
Yeah, you know, what's good about this is that it's now no longer just, a suit from, you know, a crew member to against CBS. This is basically the state saying, yeah, you know what? You can't bury this. So the next time somebody comes to human resources and says this, don't just start looking at don't start doing the calculations and think, well, it'll be better if we just kind of like move them along or fire that. Think about the long term, what might actually happen, because the cost of this may not be over the next year or two. It might be 10 years down the road.
Exactly. You got to make them pay a higher price or they'll just keep doing it.
Right. Now take that, Ozzie and Harriet. For decades, the long-running squeaky clean sitcom, The Adventures of Ozzie and Harriet, was known for two things: launching the formidable career of musician Ricky Nelson and for being the longest-running live-action sitcom in TV history with a remarkable 14-year reign. You know, it used to be the longest-running sitcom, full stop. But The Simpsons took that crown years ago, and they have more than doubled that run. You know, The Simpsons has been going for like 31 seasons now with no signs of stopping. And now, after 54 years, Ozzie and Harriet has been pushed aside by the bratty denizens of Patty's Pubs. Yes, the gang of It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia has been renewed for a 15th season by the cable channel FXX. And no, I did not stutter. That is the name of the channel, FXX.
FXXX. That you don't want the kids around when you watch.
Yeah. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal. Show has a long-running hit. It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia. Has been going on for years. But let me geek out like Sperling. You know, this is a huge accomplishment. They have been running for 15 years. It's not a trick like Survivor where they pretend to jam two seasons into each year. And so it's like Survivors are going on for 107 years. No, this is a genuine hit. It's been going on a long time. However, they have produced far fewer episodes. It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia has produced 154 episodes. That's a lot. You used to be able to do that in like five seasons in the old days because I Love Lucy would make 30 episodes a season. Dick Van Dyke Show, 30 episodes a season or more. But still, by any standard, that is a lot of episodes. That's a monster hit. But Ozzie and Harriet, they created 435 episodes. Wow. The Simpsons is at 684 episodes. But wait, Ozzie and Harriet also had a 10-year run on radio where they produced another 402 episodes. So Ozzie and Harriet on radio and TV produced 837 episodes. The Simpsons can pass them if they last another 7 seasons. So Ozzie and Harriet.
We're at 496. We are at 496, baby.
Yeah, you're right. We've passed Ozzie and Harriet's TV run. Good for us. Oh my God, that's depressing. Holy God. Someone said to me the other day, do you know you've been doing that for a decade? I go, shut up.
Now, the Writers Guild of America isn't done with its new demands. When films and TV episodes are shown overseas, you know, writers, they don't see any residuals from that. They want that to change. As the demand for TV shows and movies grows by leaps and bounds around the world, more and more money is being made via those licensing deals. Just as international box office is a bigger and bigger piece of theatrical revenue. Why shouldn't they? Why shouldn't writers get this? If studios are making money off it, why shouldn't writers get residual payments? Just as they do when movies and TV episodes air in syndication or on TBS and the like. Other points they are pushing are, well, guaranteed second steps, which we'll explain in a moment. Compensation for repeated pitches. Increased minimums for feature teams. So when you have like a team of writers, usually two, and more. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, it's a big deal. There's a lot of things they're pushing for. There are lots of areas that need fixes. And when you read what they're talking about, they seem to make a lot of sense. It's hard to argue that they're asking for the moon or things that they don't deserve or aren't reasonable. Pitching has turned into a months-long free brainstorming session. They say, pitch us. Hey, pitch us again, but give us a twist. Pitch us again, but give us another twist. You know, it's like, no.
What it's come down to is, since they don't do pilots anymore, right? They rarely do pilots. It's basically they're doing pilots through development sessions. So it's like free development.
Right. The writers are working hard and not getting paid as much as they should be. One-step deals are BS. If writers make less than 200% of the minimum, so if you're a big person like Ryan Murphy, you don't need this. But if you're smaller than that, if you make less than 200% of the minimum, you must be guaranteed payment for second steps, which mean drafts and the like, because they're going to be expected to do them anyway. And feature teams. There's a cap on health fund and pension plan contributions, which essentially halves what people get when they're on a team of two or three. There are lots of teams working on features, and those caps should apply to each writer, not the team. That is perfectly fair. The days where there was just like one guy and maybe you'd have two as a team, long-running team working on a movie, that's over with. They throw three people, four people, five people on a film. They do it all the time, and they're getting screwed when it comes to their pension and their health care. So that's got to end. I don't know what to say.
When you say first step, second step, you want to explain what that means, how it's...
I want you to explain it.
Well, as I understand it, it's if you basically do your draft... It's accepted. And then they go, oh, you know what? We actually want some more work on this.
Yeah. No, you're right. So that normally you get paid for it. Nowadays, they're just like jamming them all into one step. Ah, it's a first step deal, but do it three times.
Right, exactly.
Now, can you explain what first step is in 15 seconds?
You know what?
Tick-tock,
I can't.
Tick-tock, tick-tock.
You know, that actually is a good question. And in fact, that does bring us to Inside Baseball. Inside Baseball is where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. And today, I guess, especially if you're a parent, it definitely affects you. We're going to be joined by Natalie Jarvie, the senior digital media editor for The Hollywood Reporter. Natalie covers everything from the launch of the latest streaming video platforms, such as, say, I don't know, HBO Max, to which social media, I can never say the word social media, but to the social media platforms that are all the rage these days with the kids. And Natalie recently wrote a feature story on how TikTok has become the social media app of the moment with the in crowd and, frankly, with Hollywood. Natalie, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Now, my first question I have is, can you give me the phone number and or the email address of the CEO of TikTok? Because, you know, speaking for parents, like, I don't know, everywhere on the planet Earth, I kind of have a bone or two or three to pick with them. My kids will not put this thing down.
I don't know if I can share his personal information with you here, but I do know that TikTok has, become quite popular with young people these days and certainly become the bane of some parents' existence here during quarantine.
Do you see a classic generational divide between people over 30 saying, what? What is it? It's like YouTube, but shorter. It's like Vine.
What is TikTok? I guess that is really the first question we should, for those of us who might be over the age of 25, what is TikTok?
TikTok is a social video app. It takes a lot of its DNA from Vine, which went defunct a few years ago. So it's really short videos, usually about 15 seconds. They loop, so you know, you can just kind of watch it over and over again. And you know, it's everything from people dancing, lip syncing to songs, doing comedy sketches, cooking videos. There's a lot you can do with it, but that 15-second format is really key.
And when we've been talking about it because, of course, TikTok helped launch Old Town Road into pop music history as the longest running single of all time at number one on the Billboard charts. So that was, I think, the first time where a lot of other people said, wait, what is this? What's going on? And they saw all these cool little sketches that people did. They said, ah, they made a spoof of Old Town Road wearing this outfit or that outfit. And it just kept the song going and going and going and really helped fuel the popularity. Of course, it doesn't work if the song isn't good in the first place.
Which is why our song has never charted.
That's right.
Yeah. Also, we're not on TikTok. But now, was TikTok Musical.ly first? Because Musical.ly, I remember Musical.ly was really taking off and it was downloaded, I don't know, millions of times, I think, right?
In America.
In America, yes.
Yeah, Musical.ly started to catch on a couple of years ago, and that was really very focused on kind of lip syncing to popular songs or dancing to popular songs. The company that owns TikTok, ByteDance, came in and actually acquired Musical.ly and then merged the two platforms. So in summer 2018, a bunch of people started to see their Musical.ly apps become the TikTok app. So that actually hurt TikTok at first because Musical.ly had kind of a cringy reputation for those lip syncing songs. And a lot of celebrities and digital creators didn't want to download TikTok thinking it was going to be like Musical.ly. It took a little while to kind of gain interest in the US.
Is there anything other than momentum that distinguishes TikTok from Vine or YouTube? Obviously, the repeating of the 15-second clip, that limitation, just like Twitter had a limitation of characters originally as far as how many characters you could use, and people get creative within those limits. But there's no reason someone else couldn't have a 10-second app that was just as successful and might supplant as the cool place to be because this week it's this bar and next week it's going to be that bar. How does TikTok make sure it doesn't end up being the flavor of the moment?
Yeah, well, there is something really unique about TikTok in that it makes it very easy to create content. The popular thing to do on TikTok is to see someone do a dance and to remix it and do it yourself, or to, you know, see someone tell a joke and to kind of put your own spin on it. It's like a video meme. And so that makes it a lot easier for people to get in there and create something right away and then get hooked on it. Whereas other platforms like YouTube are kind of just this like blank canvas. You go there and you think, I don't know what to do with this. I could make anything. And then that's overwhelming. So for a lot of users, TikTok is a good place to start.
Right. So I guess we're kind of burying the lead here. And that is that some of these people on TikTok, and by people, I mean, they're mostly young kids between the ages of like 15 and 25. They have really, they've kind of blown up. And specifically, one that my kids will not stop talking about is Charli D'Amelio, who this time last year had not even probably heard of TikTok, and now she has 50 million followers on this one platform.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. So that's the other really unique thing about TikTok is it has this incredibly powerful algorithm that can take a, you know, girl next door teenager like Charli D'Amelio and turn her into an overnight sensation. And that is something that isn't always found on some of these other social video apps. And one of the reasons that I think a lot of young people like to be on TikTok is that there's this feeling that it could happen to you. Anyone could become an overnight sensation on TikTok.
But we've seen talent created on YouTube, like Justin Bieber and Logan Paul and other people. We've seen talent created on Vine, and now we're seeing talent created on TikTok. The difference here is your story focuses is that Hollywood is paying attention, and after, I mean, they have 10 years of hindsight, as you put it cleverly in the piece, because they messed up on YouTube and didn't realize there were people that they could mine and use in TV and reality shows and film and music, and now on TikTok, that's different. They're really paying attention here, aren't they?
They are. You know, I think the challenge with YouTube stars when they first popped was Hollywood didn't quite know what to do with them. Many of these YouTube stars were famous for being themselves, for posting these vlogs, and that didn't obviously translate into becoming a, you know, a Hollywood actor. Now, the Hollywood ecosystem kind of understands that these social media stars are influencers much in the way that, you know, a Kim Kardashian is a star or, you know, someone on The Real Housewives is a star. And so they figured out how to work with this talent and how to also identify talent. You know, not everyone who's lip syncing to a song or dancing on TikTok has what it takes. But
what?
But the talent agents have kind of gotten savvy to looking for, you know, for talents that can be kind of molded into, you know, a more lasting star.
Well, yeah, you kind of talk about how Charli D'Amelio, and she's not the only one. She is maybe one of the most recognized names these days.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, she's been on
The Tonight Show. She has the most followers. Yes.
Yeah. I was going to say Late Night with who at this point, which one of the late night talk
shows? It should have been Lily Singh, but it's not. Keep going.
But yes. Okay. So Lily Singh being a YouTuber who kind of jumped from YouTube fame to mainstream media fame, but these TikTok phenomenons, I don't know what you would call them. They're huge stars, TikTok star, I guess.
TikToker,
is what they would be.
Yeah.
TikToker. I mean, they have agents and managers and you spoke to some of them. What are they looking for in a TikToker that might have 10, 15, 20 million people following them? Is it just the number of followers or are they looking for something that can translate from what TikTok is to whatever it is that you know it represents in mainstream media?
Yeah, it's not the number of followers. In fact, if you talk to people in the digital media community, they say that that's kind of the least useful metric. It's really all about engagement. How much can they get people coming back, watching all of their videos, watching them over and over again. That's really key. And many of these TikTokers are starting to also build followings on Instagram and on YouTube. And so if they can translate followers to those other platforms, that's a key that they have a real lasting fan base. Outside of that, you know, they're looking for charisma. They're looking for talent. They're looking for people who are hardworking. I mean, not everyone is born an amazing actor or an amazing singer overnight.
Hello, Daniel Radcliffe.
Yeah, okay. It's real work, right? And so they have to show that they're willing to put in the work. They're willing to go to acting classes and music classes and voice lessons and all those things. And then on top of that, you know, there's different genres, right? So in the comedy space, someone who's just got good natural comedic timing, someone who's just funny. And, you know, as long as they catch them while they're young, they can really mold them and help them shape a career into whatever they want it to be.
Well, now Sperling made a mistake there because he said, you know, it's like going from TikTok to mainstream media. Well, if you're on late night television and you're reaching 2 million people and you're on TikTok and you have 10 million followers, which one is mainstream? People are recognizing that these people are mainstream. A lot of eyeballs are watching them and paying attention to their content, aren't they? That's why they're interested in them, along with the talent and the charisma.
Yeah. And honestly, a lot of these up and coming digital stars, they don't necessarily want to become a quote unquote mainstream actor or, you know, traditional TV star. They're very happy with the audience that they've been able to build on their own with a lot of independence. They're not reliant on a big studio or a TV network to say, hey, you're the person. They can build that on their own. What they do need help with is, you know, in booking those brand deals and getting those speaking engagements and all the other things that, you know, kind of a more traditional Hollywood ecosystem can help them with.
But they're already making 6 and 7 figures a year, aren't they?
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask. What are these agents and managers you know, what are all these personnel doing and how are TikTokers making money?
Because they're not making money on TikTok, which was the big problem with Vine and why Vine died on the Vine, because people could be on Vine, but they weren't making the money Vine was. TikTok says it's going to be different. And the users, as you report in your story, say good things like, well, they flew us out here for an event. They're giving us gifts at the holidays, but that's sort of noblesse oblige. That's not about like giving you a piece of the pie and an active ongoing monetization the way YouTube does in a certain respect. So what's going to happen and what has to change with TikTok to make sure they don't lose these people to other platforms?
Yeah, so right now, TikTokers can make money by connecting directly with brands to do sponsored videos. And TikTok does have a marketplace where they will help connect talent with brands. So they are doing that. There's also things like fans can tip during live streams. That money goes to the TikTokers. And then another big area of revenue, as you mentioned earlier with Old Town Road, is that the music labels are now paying TikTokers to debut songs on the platform and to help kind of gin up interest around new releases. So there are a number of ways for the talent to make money, but none of that is a kind of shared revenue program the way that YouTube shares revenue. YouTube has really been kind of the only platform to share revenue as kind of deeply and to build this kind of lasting program. So TikTok will need to look to start adding those types of features if they want to keep their talent on the platform and keep them happy. And they've said that they're exploring it. These are things that aren't built overnight. Instagram just announced recently that they're going to start sharing ad revenue on IGTV videos with creators. And Instagram's been around for a while. So, you know, it does take time to build these tools.
So now what does that look like? You report that, you know, that some TikTokers, that is just a word that will not come out of my mouth for some reason.
That's why you're not on TikTok.
That is probably very true, actually. Although actually maybe me trying to say TikToker would be a good
hilarious 15 seconds. Keep going.
Yeah. Okay. So these record labels are approaching some of these well-known TikTokers to debut their music and some of their new releases. They're paid upwards of $25,000. What does that look like? How does that work? Do they just say, here's a 3-minute song, premiere it in 15-second spurts?
Yeah, I mean, it's really happening very ad hoc. And it's, you know, all levels of TikTokers will get DMs basically from the record labels saying, hey, we're seeing you've got this growing audience. Do you want to debut our new song? And here's some cash to do it. Some TikTokers also do it for free. Charli D'Amelio has done it for free just because it's good for her fans and it's good for her to build those relationships. But yeah, you know, it's not super formalized. It's getting more and more formalized as these TikTokers are starting to sign with agents and managers and have people doing those deals. But, you know, it's been really kind of organic.
Well, so the actual brand ad, not the record label, how does that work? You have 15 seconds to basically pitch something?
Yeah, I mean, most digital creators want to do something that feels organic to their content. Their fans, especially young kind of Gen Z fans, can really suss out when something just doesn't feel right and someone's just kind of shilling for a product that they don't really care about. So typically they'll do something with a product that they already feel strongly about or use in their daily lives, and they'll try to integrate it in a fun way into their video so that the video is still engaging and entertaining, but also happens to support a brand.
And of course, it's not just a new celebrities being built on TikTok. Famous people are coming into that space as well. J-Lo and A-Rod have been TikToking during the pandemic. Jason Derulo singing along to his own song. That's very funny. So who's being the most successful celebrity to take advantage of this? And what's the advantage to them? Just the fact that it's where young people are. It's a new platform. I better stay engaged there. Or is it the fact that they can do it so quickly and easily and be creative and goofy?
Yeah, well, this is one of the reasons I wanted to write about TikTok during the shutdown here is because a number of traditional celebrities had started to come onto the app, but it really felt like that ramped up when everyone was suddenly stuck at home. And what I found really interesting about it is that someone like J-Lo basically has the same means to create a video as Charli D'Amelio. They're both just shooting these videos on their cell phones while they're stuck at home. The quality is going to be about the same. It really kind of breaks down those barriers between a digital star and, you know, a traditional star. And so that was really kind of fun to watch. And a lot of kind of mainstream celebrities are getting in on it. You've mentioned a few of them. I think Terry Crews is having a lot of fun with it. He's been posting a lot of videos with his 14-year-old son. You know, Jack Black made a splash with some of his videos early during the shelter in place mandate. So a number of them are getting in on it and, you know, kind of finding what works for them.
Well, what I liked was how you described it. You said people have been flocking to TikTok, each dance routine or snappy sketch like a shot of dopamine, which is definitely a good way to describe what it's like to be on TikTok. And for the first time, you made me actually pay attention to it beyond just recognizing it. I actually started to search for some of the names and see what they're doing for 15-second spurts. I can do that. But there are some more serious sides to this. It does, of course, have Chinese-based ownership, and that does create a challenge, as you wrote in your story. And I think this is interesting. In an effort to distance TikTok from its Chinese operations and concerns about censorship, ByteDance, its owner, says it has moved its content moderators out of the country and that it plans to open a, quote, transparency center, end quote, in Los Angeles, where it keeps its North American headquarters. That's really staying ahead of the curve in terms of thinking about your company's profile and what could hurt it as far as being a worldwide phenomenon when you're based in a totalitarian state.
Absolutely. And they've had to, because already they're facing some government regulations. The U.S. government is looking very closely at what they're doing. They recently announced that Disney executive Kevin Mayer is coming over to the company to become its CEO. So yes, that is a further effort by them to show, look at, like, we're, you know, we are this, you know, U.S. based company product. And, you know, yes, we've got this Chinese ownership, but, you know, we're going to adhere to those rules.
So maybe my Hong Kong 15-second protest video will stay up online next time.
We will have to see.
Well, now you mentioned Kevin Mayer, and you also cover, digital media, which I assume you covered Disney Plus. I know you did, because
of course you did.
I referenced Jesus. But he was with Disney Plus and he left. So someone in your position these days, I'm surprised you even have time to talk to us. I mean, isn't there, I think in the time we've been talking, there's probably been three or four more platforms that have launched.
They've launched and already died. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, were you surprised by him jumping to TikTok? Because Disney Plus was a very successful launch. There's a lot to do there. That's going to be a big brand for a long time. The idea of jumping to TikTok, maybe it's exciting, maybe it has more ownership or more value in it, but what do you think pulled him there?
It's definitely a very different kind of job for him. I do think that it started first and foremost from the fact that he was not named Disney's new CEO, and he certainly seemed kind of primed to take on that job. So sure that caused him to start looking for some other opportunities. Now, although, you know, he's not run a social media company before, what it does signal to me is that TikTok was really serious about finding ways to build a real sustainable business off of this app. You know, they need to create some, you know, kind of monetization features and grow their revenue there. And he probably is a good guy to do that. It also shows that they're pretty serious about, you know, remaining connected with Hollywood and with the entertainment community. They see those kind of those links in a way that's very different than, say, a YouTube or a Twitter or an Instagram that are all run by kind of very tried and true Silicon Valley tech executives. So it's a very different kind of appointment for TikTok.
Well, speaking of Instagram, you know, after it became such a huge success, eventually brands found it and they launched their own channels or their own accounts. And then they would be interspersed with, you know, their posts and sponsored posts would be interspersed with different photos. How are brands doing? I mean, are brands or television shows or studios for their movies, are they doing the same thing on TikTok? And if so, would it be effective? How would people even find that?
Would they want a 15-second trailer in between a 15-second clip from their favorite celeb?
Yeah, so brands are just starting to come on to TikTok. Right now, it's really experimental, and it's largely those brands who know they really want to connect with a young, predominantly female audience. Netflix has advertised a number of shows on the platform. Apple TV Plus has advertised. I believe Quibi ran some ads right around its launch. So they're starting to do that. There's a few different ways that they'll advertise. One is when you first open the app, an ad will play before you kind of dive into the rest rest of the content. So it's not necessarily always popping up in between the videos. It's kind of the first thing you see when you open the app. The other thing that they can do is they can sponsor a hashtag. So they can, you know, kind of then try to get users to post their own videos using that hashtag. It's kind of a more organic way to get the word out about a product and kind of grow awareness. And a number of creators will oftentimes also, you know, be paid to, you know, promote whatever it is the brand wants to promote by posting a video with that hashtag.
Well, everybody's competing for eyeballs. So whether you're on Instagram or TikTok or Disney Plus, it's the same competition. And that brings us to HBO Max, which you have discussed at their launch. I'm fascinated by two things. One is that there's mentioned, I just heard for the first time that there might be an ad-supported tier that would come out in 2021. For some reason, that blows my mind. I don't know why. And two, I wonder, why would any single person ever subscribe to HBO via a cable company again? Nobody would ever do that nowadays. As long as you can access the app and have it on your TV, you're going to sign up for HBO Max and go around the cable company right from the get-go, aren't you? This really has to be an existential threat to HBO as a cable channel.
Yeah, I think John Stankey, who until recently was CEO of Warner Media, said that it was like an IQ test for users. Why would anyone just subscribe to HBO when they could get HBO Max? Now, the one caveat there is that HBO Max did not launch with all the distribution partners they wanted to launch with. So some people who have Roku devices and who get their entertainment content via Amazon channels, will still only be able to access the HBO Now app. They won't be able to get HBO Max unless they go onto their phone or another device. So for some people, it's just going to be the way that it's going to have to be until those distribution deals do fall into place. But yeah, it's, you know, it definitely is going to change what people think of as the HBO brand. I mean, you go on to HBO Max and The Sopranos and The Wire and Game of Thrones are now all alongside a bunch
friends.
Of, you know, Friends and, you know, a bunch of Criterion Collection movies and, you know, TBS and all of that. So it really will change how people think about that brand going forward.
And an ad-supported tier, is that a reaction to Peacock and thinking, hey, we might as well have a version that's free or much less expensive?
Reaction to a kind of a growing sense that, you know, people are going to get subscription fatigue with all of these different streaming services available. It suddenly starts to cost about the same to subscribe to all of them as it would be to just go out and subscribe to cable. And so companies do have to provide a number of different price points for users. You know, what exactly that tier looks like, we don't know yet. I don't know that all of HBO's content will necessarily be available ad supported. It's never been before. So that would be a big deal if that's what they choose to do. But, you know, certainly, you know, I think they want to show the value of paying $15 a month by giving you something for free and saying, see, now you have the choice. You know, Hulu has said that the best thing they ever did was launch an ad-free tier, because all the people who used to complain about ads suddenly stopped complaining about ads when they saw, oh, I can just pay more money and not have ads. Even if they didn't choose to do that, it kind of quelled those criticisms. So I imagine that Warner Media is thinking the same thing in reverse, right? All those people complaining about spending $15 a month, well, let's give them an ad-supported version, and then, you know, that'll kind of show them, you know, what they're paying for.
You know, we may not have been able to predict the rise of TikTok, Michael, but we did predict, like several years ago, that people would get tired of subscriptions, that eventually they'd turn around and go,
right.
Wait,
I'm tired of my cable bill. Wait, I'm paying $400 for the cable I used to access. And you had one other story I'd like to mention very quickly. You talked about podcasts and you said there are so many podcasts proliferating that episodes are getting shorter, to which we say, ha.
Well, it is interesting.
We are single-handedly raising the bar on that.
Absolutely.
The average length of a podcast.
It has been interesting to track, you know, the podcast space in the last few years, as, you know, kind of certainly Hollywood has started to pay more attention. I mean, I'm now covering podcasts for The Hollywood Reporter, so that's new and different. I think what it is that, you know, there's certainly a lot more mini series and shows that are trying to, you know, be geared towards someone's commute. So we are seeing some of those episode lengths go down. But that study that you're referring to from Stitcher found that a number of folks also like to sit and binge listen to podcasts, much the way that they'll binge watch TV. So, you know, listening is certainly, you know, going up.
I think you'll see that in the TV space as well, if we can call it TV or streaming, because I've been noticing more and more TV shows like The End of the Effing World and other shows that are have episodes that are 17 minutes long, 19 minutes long. They don't feel the need to space out to 30 minutes or 40 or, you know, so I'm finding more and more shows I'm stumbling on are sort of odd lengths or shorter lengths than normal that they wouldn't have been free to do if they were on a TV space. They're just streaming like, you know what, at 21 minutes, we're done. We're done.
Yeah, when you're not beholden to those half hour or hour long programming blocks, you can get a little bit more creative and then kind of, you know, tailor the length of the show to what needs to be done for, you know, telling the best story. I have to now constantly look at how long the episode is before I actually start watching it, because sometimes I'll think I'm watching a half hour show that really is 45 minutes. Or
like Sex Education. I thought for sure Sex Education was half an hour and it's like 45 minutes. It's a drama. So I was like, what?
Exactly. Yeah.
Now, what are the podcasts that are doing that are making the biggest splash, that are getting the bigger audiences? Are they these crime, you know, kind of?
Well, that was last week's flavor. Come on. There'll be something new by now.
TikTok podcasts? I don't know.
Well, a lot of TikTokers are launching podcasts. Charli D'Amelio, in fact, announced one with her sister a couple of weeks ago. So
She has a reality TV deal as well with the people behind American Idol, I believe.
Yes. There's a number of reality TV shows in the works right now centered around TikTok stars. It will be interesting to see which of those actually find their way to air and, you know, if they can become kind of the next, you know, Kardashian family or, you know, kind of capture audiences in the same way. But it does seem like Hollywood is very interested in finding ways to kind of show off the kind of crazy world of becoming a TikTok star overnight.
Well, you know, Michael, the one thing I've learned is we're doing it wrong. Whatever we're doing, we must be doing it wrong.
That's right.
50 million followers. That's a lot of people.
We need to dance. Ellen dances. Charli dances. Someday soon we'll be dancing. But we do appreciate you taking the time to talk with us. It was great to read your story. We'll have links in our show notes. Is there any other way people should follow you that we can point them to beyond, of course, looking for your stuff on The Hollywood Reporter?
I tweet a lot of my stories from my Twitter handle, which is at Nat Jarv.
And that's J-R-V.
J-A-R-V.
J-A-R-V. Sorry. It's sitting right in front of me.
You can't spell.
I can't read. Yes, yes. Unbelievable. Well, Natalie, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Well, that was great of Natalie Jarvie to join us. She was a great guest. I look forward to reading her other stuff and having her back on the show sometime soon.
Yeah, she is very prolific. And, you know, I love reading her stuff. Whenever there is something with her byline on it, I always know like, ooh, this is going to be good.
Well, and you know that if she's covering some new social platform, it might mean the last one is dead and gone, like Instagram, yesterday's news.
Well, okay, so I guess you're moving us along into our obituary section where, you know, I'm going to say a name, Michael, that not a lot of people may remember or know. Herb Stemple.
I know him.
Who is?
Well, if you don't know who Herb Stemple is, just think of John Turturro. He played him in Robert Redford's 1994 film Quiz Show. That is a great movie. It came out 26 years ago. It has really withstood the test of time. It's his best film, and it's a truly great film, I think. It's one of the best of that year, if not the best. Herb Stemple was a whistleblower on the rigged game shows that were occurring in the live heyday of television when quiz shows were dominating like they did in the era of Who Wants to Be a Millionaire and so on. He has died at the age of 93. He's a fascinating, complex guy. Watch that film and you will care about what happened to Herb Stemple. Not that they make him as a wildly sympathetic guy. He's complex. He's annoying, but it's a very good movie and it really shines a great light on that era.
Now, speaking of an era and a great light and an interesting character.
And a pain in the ass.
Yeah. Larry Kramer, playwright, activist. He died at the age of 84, which is, in a way, it's, I don't want to say ironic timing because that's just horrible, but it's interesting.
That's not ironic. It's amazing he survived this long, though I imagine it kills him that he had to die before Donald Trump was, as he would be hoping, voted out of office. NPR described him best. They said Larry Kramer is one of America's most valuable troublemakers. And that's absolutely true. He was famously antagonistic. But you know, when you watch a plague slaughter everyone you know, that can tend to upset a person. He was also right about pretty much everything. And I say that as a person who disagreed with him at times vehemently. He helped found Gay Men's Health Crisis. He then went to help found ACT UP. That was founded in his living room, or GMHC was. I forget which one. Maybe both of them. Everyone seeing the speed with which the medical and scientific community is moving on COVID-19 should thank him. Anyone who sees patients for breast cancer or whatever the illness you or your loved ones have ever faced, when you see patients sitting on advisory boards that oversee the research into those problems like MS or whatever it might be, you can thank Larry Kramer and ACT UP and the groups he helped founded, because that is why there has been a revolution in how we have patient care and patients have a voice. But he was also a talent in the film industry. He began as a production exec. He worked on Lawrence of Arabia and Dr. Strangelove. I didn't know that. Then he said, I want to make my own project. And he optioned the novel Women in Love, and he produced it as a film. He won an Academy Award nomination for his screenplay, and it became a big hit for him, Glenda Jackson, and director Ken Russell. In fact, Glenda Jackson won the Best Actress Oscar. So his first movie out, he produced an Oscar-winning film. That's pretty great. And then, of course, as a playwright, he wrote the landmark work The Normal Heart, which was a thunderbolt and won the Tony Award for Best Revival in 2011. His adaptation for HBO won him an Emmy. Famously, Barbara Streisand optioned it and just drove him nuts by not making the movie. And they butted heads over how it should be. But it all works out in the end. Other plays followed, none of them nearly as important, along with books like Faggots, which was a huge landmark book that made him a hated figure in the gay community, as he so often was. He managed to antagonize everybody, even the people who loved him most. Most recently had a multi-volume epic, The American People. He said, most people seem to review me, not the book. Loudmouth activist Larry Kramer has written a loudmouth book, end quote. That's about right. And in an open letter published in San Francisco many years ago, he called Dr. Anthony Fauci a killer and, quote, an incompetent idiot, end quote. They later became friends, with Fauci telling the New York Times, once you got past the rhetoric, you found Larry Kramer made a lot of sense and that he had a heart of gold. So he really is an important figure. We don't have time for my little brush with fame with Larry Kramer. He once complimented a story I wrote. I was thought I'd won the lottery. I was like, really? I did a cover story for The Advocate on the film A Beautiful Mind. It's a story I'm definitely proud of. And he said it was really well written. He told it to my editor. And I thought, oh my God, you'd hate me if you met me. So that really means something. So it's a fascinating person. And he never changed. Outside that Normal Heart revival, it won the Tony for Best Revival in 2011. He was outside that theater every day, handing out pamphlets, talking about the latest issues with AIDS and how it hadn't gone away and there needed to be more funding and this needed to happen and that needed to happen. He never stopped.
Yeah, well, you know, it's time for us to stop, actually, this particular episode. But before we do, you remember David Wilde, right?
Of course.
Yeah, Rolling Stone contributing editor. He's been a guest on the show many times.
Friend to Neil Diamond.
Yeah, friend, that is true, actually, friend to Neil Diamond. I just happened to pull up Twitter because the curfew here in Los Angeles has just been moved up from 8 to 6 to 5 p.m.
Ours is 7 p.m. in Birmingham. They just announced that.
Well, David Wilde writes on Twitter, this is America, led by someone who acts both childish and like a Gambino. Yeah, took a Gambino crime family, you know, like a Gambino. Yeah,
I got it.
Yeah, but you really have to know your mafia history for that one to work, right? I mean, also your music, because you'd have to know that Childish Gambino. Well, anyway, you know what? You can subscribe to our show in iTunes, the Google Play Store, Microsoft Marketplace, Stitcher, anywhere they give podcasts away for free. You can subscribe to us, rate, review us in any of those podcast aggregators. It does help us out when you do that. In fact, you know, if you subscribe to us, you'll never miss any of my corny jokes. Because you'll get a new episode every week. Now, you can find that information on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's where you'll find links to all of the stories we've discussed on today's episode, as well as links to the work of Natalie Jarvie. I'd like to thank her from The Hollywood Reporter. Thank her for being here. We'll place links to her work, to her Twitter handle, or Twitter account, not her handle. Our Twitter handle is at showbizsandbox. And we're on Facebook. Facebook.com/showbizsandbox is where you can like our page. You can also email us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. Or you can call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. Again, all that information on our website, showbizsandbox.com. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on their own website, whoismgmt.com. Michael Gilt has a website, and every week it's something new and exciting. What is it this week, Michael?
This week it's gmhc.org. That's gaymenshealthcrisis.org, a worthy organization that still does great work.
And you know what? If you can't find any of Michael's coverage of the entertainment industry there, why not head on over to michaelgiltz.com, where all of his work is aggregated. Some of my work can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.